Folks, have you checked out the Irish History Podcast shop recently? Right now, I have a sale of 30% off everything when you use the code SALE30. So go to irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and get 30% off everything when you use the discount code SALE30.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer and this is On the Lash, a history of drinking in Ireland. Today's podcast is a look at the history of drink and drink culture in Ireland. Now, this country is well known for problematic attitudes to alcohol. I think this is best summarised by the fact that while Ireland traditionally has high rates of alcohol abuse, it also has one of the highest rates of abstinence as well, which indicates a strange relationship. This podcast is going to pick this apart, look at our drinking habits over the last 800 years, bringing us right up to the present day. I should say, before we begin, some of you have been in touch about the series Partisans on Irish involvement in the Spanish Civil War. That is returning, but it won't be back until February. A new archive of letters written by Irish nuns who were in Spain during the Spanish Civil War has literally been released to the public for the first time this week, and I'm going to go through them next Wednesday. Now, given that these have never been seen before, I think it's worth holding back to see if there's any new perspectives in that archive. I'm also at the moment asking for you, the listeners of the show, for your opinions on what directions the upcoming series on the Irish War of Independence should take. You can give me your opinions at irishhistorypodcast.ie/survey. There's a few questions there. It'll only take you about 60 seconds, but it's invaluable information for me as I design that series going forward over the next couple of months. Also, while you're there, check out the new shop. At the moment, there's a lovely selection of pins available there. They're made from metal and enamel and depict some of the most famous people in Irish history over the last 1,000 years. These include the revolutionary Countess Markovitch, the famous chieftain Grace O'Malley, the Fenian and tenants' rights activist Michael Davitt, all the way back to Brian Boru. Now, you can get these at irishhistorypodcast.ie as well. Finally, I have a live recording coming up on February the 9th in Cork. Tickets are available at uticket.ie. I'll put an exact link in the show notes, but that's coming up in Cork on February the 9th, and it'll be great crack. I'll hopefully see lots of you there. Now, we can turn to today's topic. For this episode, I'm joined by DJ Walsh, who's the host of Snugcast, which is a podcast that's recorded in pubs. And in that tradition, we're recording this in a pub. So DJ, do you want to say hello and explain your podcast?
Hi everyone, thanks for having me on, Finn. I'm the co-host of Snugcast with my friend Owen Tabb, and we record a podcast once a week in pubs, typically in Waterford or Kilkenny in the southeast of Ireland. And basically the whole premise of the podcast is we want to bring pub chat, typical pub chat in Ireland, to the listeners, where we just talk about different topics, sometimes serious, sometimes less serious, and we just have a casual conversation and try and enjoy ourselves while enjoying some local craft beer and enjoying the ambience of whatever pub we're in, such as the great ambience here in the Hole in the Wall.
Well, actually, as DJ says there, and following in their great tradition, we decided to record this episode of the podcast in a pub, and I suppose we can't go any further without talking about where we are. As DJ mentioned, we're in a pub called the Hole in the Wall. Now, the building that the Hole in the Wall is in was actually built back in 1582. To put that into context, this building was standing when Queen Elizabeth was sitting on the throne in England. But we're going to start talking about the history of drinking and drink culture in Ireland, and we're going to go even back before that. So we're going to start back in the late medieval period, around the 12th and 13th century. And we're going to look a bit about what people drank, why they drank it, and how that has changed over the last 6-7 centuries. And then we'll talk a bit about drinking culture in Ireland today and the pros and cons to it. I suppose a good place to start is what people drank. And most people would associate whiskey as being a very traditional Irish drink. But in the medieval period, the two main drinks that people drank were wine and ale. Wine being, largely speaking, the drink of the aristocracy, ale being a much more common drink. Now, people drank huge amounts of ale, and it's worth bearing in mind, if you look through records where it pops up, people will often be talking about things like 15 gallons of ale. But it's worth looking at that ale, and actually alcohol in general, had a very different role in society. Obviously, people drank it for fun. You can see lots of accounts of taverns and people socialising in taverns. But also, it comes back to this issue of water quality in the medieval period. And I don't know, DJ, do you want to say a bit about that role of alcohol in the medieval period?
Yeah, I suppose the water quality, it was putrid. It wasn't drinkable, and people would put themselves at risk, their health at risk and their lives at risk if they drank water. Whereas actually, ale, because it had alcohol content in it, it would stave off bacterial growth. So that meant it was people were able to hydrate themselves and get some nourishment from ale. The ale that we're talking about is completely different than the ale that we consume today. We're talking about a lower percentage, absolute volume of alcohol in these ales. But that being said, like you said, Finn, there was the class divide was definitely there between ale and wine.
It's also actually, it's also used for nutritional value as well, because yep. The ale at the time is, some people talk about it being almost porridge-like in it, but then that's an exaggeration, but it's a much richer drink in terms of its content. That said, while we talk about it as being a pure source of water, for want of a better word, but given the poor state of, say, wells and things like that in urban areas, it's worth saying that there is problems associated with alcohol consumption in the medieval period. It's not just being used for medicinal purposes or things like that. And I was going through a couple of things in preparing for this podcast. And for example, in 1367, the Archbishop of Dublin at the time complained that people weren't engaging in religious activities and feast days, but instead they were spending the days in taverns and drunkenness and other illicit acts of pleasure. And then there's lots of cases of violence directly associated with and resulting from alcohol consumption. And you can see this in medieval court records where there's countless occasions where alcohol, you know, it's probably the same as today. It's not the root cause of this violence, but it's certainly feeding into it. And taverns are seen as places where violence takes place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even looking further back than that, something that I picked up in a previous Irish History podcast episode was you mentioned back in, even in the Viking Ireland, Glúnearing was killed by a slave in a drunken argument.
Yeah, Glúnearing was a king of Dublin who was, yeah. Although I would imagine that slave had probably lots of other reasons for killing the king at the time.
However, there's no doubt that there was copious amounts of alcohol consumed when it took place. But you mentioned whiskey as well earlier, Finn, as being the one that you have the connotations with. But the medieval period of Ireland we're talking about, distillation wasn't a thing then.
No, but it does come in. It's certainly here by the 15th century. And early in the 15th century, there's a reference to a certain Richard Burke who had died drinking. And in that record, what it says is that he died from drinking aqua vitae, which is the water of life often used to describe whiskey. But it says in the record, it says to him it was aqua mortis,
and of
water,
course
water of death.
Exactly, and of course to this day in the Irish language, the Irish phrase for whiskey is ish-ka-baha, which directly also translates to the water of life. So you can see how once distillation came in, quickly the water of life became, you know, absolutely instilled in Irish society.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting. Over the following centuries, ale, I guess, goes down massively in consumption, and spirits become much more the alcohol of choice. Now, the exact reasons for this aren't entirely understood and aren't entirely clear, but certainly if you fast forward a couple of centuries, the big drink that people are consuming is distilled spirits. And this leads to a very, I suppose, you're heading into a period, say certainly by the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, where you're heading in to the start and then the growth of the Industrial Revolution. Now, in England, one of the big problems you get is something called the gin craze. People may have heard about this, is where people are drinking copious amounts of gin. Very disturbing, like, to read about it. Often what this is put down to is the horrific, say, conditions in factories, that people are working in appalling conditions, so they're drinking huge amounts of alcohol to kind of numb their senses. Interestingly, gin, though, wasn't popular in Ireland. It had come to England with William of Orange, and was very much seen at the time as a Protestant drink. So obviously the majority of the population in Ireland, being Catholic, would have not drank gin. That says huge amounts of whiskey are being drunk. And while England has its problem with the gin craze, you could probably say Ireland has a problem with the whiskey craze to an extent. You can see it in the 18th and 19th century, where it's contributing to very serious violence. I've covered two, say, for example, minor incidents. But they're not minor, but they're examples. At Wild Goose Lodge in 1816, and then later in that century at Mam Trasna in 1882, where secret societies on those occasions brutally murder families. But alcohol plays this huge role in that, in the form of Dutch courage. But you also see it in incidents, like, say, for example, in the 1790s, and again through the 19th century, where you have serious sectarian rioting in Ireland, and alcohol is seen to be playing a very prominent role in these disturbances, and is being identified in society as being very problematic. And I suppose if we wanted to talk about the emergence maybe of alcohol as the social ill in the way that we understand it today, maybe you could start looking at its roots in this period. You get the first major, I suppose, modern abstinence movement in the 1830s, I think it is, and people would probably be familiar with the person who started that. That's Father Theobald Matthew. There's a statue to him in Cork, I think, isn't there? And there's, yep, a Dublin, there's a bridge in Dublin named after him. He started this movement for abstinence, which was wildly popular. And, like, I think we often think back in Irish history as Ireland being a country of big drinkers, but in the 1840s, around the time of the famine, you get somewhere, you're talking about millions of people who have signed up to this pledge not to drink. And I think that reflects probably part of the... Now, it reflects, obviously, on one level, the church is taking a very moralistic approach to alcoholism. You can see why they're doing it. But at the same time, you have to question, is this a healthy way to approach this problem? But you can see that it is popular because millions of people are supporting this idea of abstinence. And it is... You can see some of the ways that is... Actually, alcohol abuse is seen as problematic. Like, for example, when the Young Irelanders are preparing for their revolt in 1848... they're all taking this pledge that they're not going to drink until the rebellion happens, because alcohol is seen as, yeah, I suppose, the loose talk costs lives, that someone in a pub might give away the secrets of what they're preparing to do.
Absolutely. But I think as well, the period that you're talking about, when you're talking about the late 18th, early 19th century as well, we're seeing something that has a catastrophic effect on Irish society in another way, an increased dependence on the potato. So notwithstanding poaching, it becomes a prevalent drink in Irish, yeah, society in this period of time. And I suppose all of a sudden, when you're dependent on the potato for not just your food and sustenance, you're living, Irish society at the time, the vast majority of people are living in squalor, hypothesizing they're looking for an escape. The potato, they were heavily reliant on it, so they became reliant on it for their drink as well.
Society is very repressive.
Yeah.
Even if, you know, like, you're talking about people who... You know, Ireland is not a democracy in the early 19th century. You're talking about the aftermath maybe of things like the 1798 rebellion. Then there's been, say, for example, serious upheaval around the Tide War. You know, so the society, you can see reasons why people might be drinking. But also, I guess, talking about poaching, the alcohol content in that is also very high, and maybe feeding into this idea of an abstinence movement having very real, yeah, reasons in society that this must have been creating quite serious problems.
It probably is a two-way street, and you probably do see people in abject poverty who are looking at maybe their parents who are consuming too much poaching, and it's having a detrimental effect on their ability to provide for their family. So this might be driving a younger...
I actually came across a very bleak story on that front. It's kind of related to it. That during the famine, someone who had been in the North Dublin workhouse leaves, and he seems to be squatting or something in the house, and then he's going to go back to the workhouse, but he's a chronic alcoholic, and he actually goes off drinking instead, doesn't go to the workhouse, and eventually dies. But this person has lived through the famine, survived to the end, is obviously in a very desperate condition. You can see this by the fact that he had to go to the workhouse, but when there's an autopsy carried out on his body, his liver was so enlarged that it had pushed his lung out of place. And But that just shows this level of addiction. You know, we talk about it today, and it was an issue in the 19th century where someone literally drank themselves to death, was able to survive a famine, but at the end of it, drink themselves to death. Just coming on to the end of the famine, I think if you wanted to say where does modern drinking habits emerge, I think it's very much at the end of the famine. And what you see emerging there is due to changes in legislation where spirits become, basically, long story short, spirits are taxed more. Naturally then that leads to a switch back to ale. Now this is partly driven by this desire to try and curb excessive drinking, but you see this huge soaring in the amount of alcohol being consumed, or sorry, the amount of ale being consumed in Ireland. So it goes from like 3.5 gallons per person in per year in 1851 up to 23 gallons in 1901. Now, it should be said that wine is drank in Ireland at this stage, but it's largely irrelevant. Again, you're talking about a very small layer at the top of society drinking it. But spirits consumption, while ale starts to increase, spirits consumption is declining because it's been taxed more and there's been much more rigorous pursuit of it by the police. But also, there's probably evidence that people are just drinking less spirits because there's a kind of touching on what you were saying earlier, DJ. You've got this generation now who've grown up around the temperance movement, and maybe they don't abstain completely themselves, but they're less likely to be drinking huge amounts of alcohol. And this may be just one of the influences of Father Theobald Matthew's movement. That movement had largely declined, or had totally declined by this point, but that this may have been a kind of an after effect of that movement, that it has this influence that Irish people, while they're still drinking, and probably drinking quite a lot, they're not drinking spirits that had been a problem. And this is leading to this quite a substantial change. People often talk, I suppose, bringing it right now into the early 20th century. By this point, people talk about what kind of a revolution in drinking had taken place, where people have moved almost totally away from spirits consumption. It's gone down hugely. And this kind of the movement of ale drinking, and I suppose modern drinking habits are starting to emerge. And I suppose at this point, it's worth mentioning Guinness. You can't have a conversation around alcohol in Ireland without talking about Guinness.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Recently, I had a minor argument with a close friend that brought up things from my past that I really needed to get off my chest. I think we've all been there. Now, I found therapy a really great way to work through these issues. For me, I really like online therapy, and BetterHelp is a really great online service that allows you to make space for therapy no matter how busy you are. BetterHelp is convenient, affordable, and gives you the support you need, but also works around your schedule. It's really easy to get up and running with a therapist on BetterHelp. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. You can do your sessions by text, phone, or video call, whichever suits you best. It's all about flexibility, working around your schedule. At the moment, BetterHelp are offering listeners to the show 10% off their first month. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Irish History today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Irish History.
Absolutely not. I mean, Guinness has dominated the alcohol scene in Ireland for, It celebrated its 250th anniversary 11 years ago now. We're recording this in 2020, bear in mind. So it's 261 years in existence. But it has absolutely dominated the Irish alcohol scene for the last 120 years, without a doubt. And I suppose consumption of beer and stout was on the decline throughout the 19th century. But at the turn of the 20th century, you definitely see this massive increase in Guinness consumption. And you see this increase in consumption of beer across all aspects of society. But by 1900, they're operating the largest brewery in the world. They've got 2,000 people employed in Dublin. And by the time they get to the 1920s, which a critical time in Ireland's, I suppose, in the history of Ireland, that they're branding themselves as quintessentially Irish. Which is quite funny when you look at the origins of Arctic Guinness and where it came
exactly,
from.
I guess it's that thing they felt they couldn't move Guinness out of Ireland.
Yeah.
That Guinness was tied to Ireland and that Ireland had become largely independent, so they had no choice but to embrace this, and they become this idea that they are almost representative of an independent Ireland. Yeah. And I suppose it's... Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, I think as well, in modern Ireland, certainly Guinness advertisements on the television are great, but you look at historically, like some of the posters around rural Ireland that have stood the test of time are all Guinness advertisements. And I would say that at the time, Guinness are brilliant at promoting themselves. And promoting then, themselves as Irish, I reckon, because you have to look at this concept of Irish and the drinking culture around Ireland. It is prevalent at the time, and you see that in documented films based on, say, New York around the time. You have this entire culture of the fighting Irish, the drunken Irish.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly Guinness are more than happy
to embrace
this.
Okay.
It's good for business, I reckon.
Yeah. And I think that's, you're starting to see a really unhealthy national image. And I think it'd be good if we can move on to that soon enough, this idea that the problematic attitude that Irish people have, that on one level we kind of embrace this idea of being kind of the alcoholic, the drunk, and I suppose maybe people who really embody this are people like Brendan Behan, to a lesser extent, the Dubliners, so Shane McGowan, this idea that, you know, it's almost great to be drinking yourself into oblivion, rather than kind of looking at this and going, this is a really serious problem. Now, I think this is also related to another thing in Irish society, which is the flip side of it, that there was never a healthy attitude. And back now, we've talked about Guinness emerging and this culture of, suppose, drinking pints in the 1920s or in the early 20th century, where it's really solidified itself in that 50 years after the famine. But at the start of that, at this point, you also get the emergence of a new abstinence movement. And like this abstinence movement is huge. For example, in Croke Park in 1949, you have 80,000 people attend a rally for this abstinence movement. And by 1968, 42%, I was stunned by this, 42% of the Irish population are pioneers. They're not drinking at all. Now, at the same time, you've got that, but at the same time you've got a huge number of alcoholics in the country. Yeah. And I think this reflects this, either it's all or nothing. The idea, like you do in the podcast a lot, the idea of having a sociable drink. Mm. But, you know, that alcohol is part of life as opposed to being, you know, going out and having a couple of pints of an evening as opposed to going out and having, going binge drinking or not drinking at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the, you know, in order to fully embrace our relationship and develop a more mature and modern relationship with alcohol in Ireland, you have to look at the reasons why we have the relationship we have with alcohol to begin with. And even there, like we've talked about we briefly touched on the impact that the states might have had on the image of an Irish alcoholic. Remember again, like the prohibition in the 1930s
that actually had
so many Irish distilleries
that had a huge impact in Ireland.
Absolutely, but at the same time too, it's so many Irish distilleries closed down at that time that it just promoted and fueled the beer industry. It promoted, like, it gave Smithwick's and Guinness a really strong foothold in Irish drinking cultures, because if your local distillery closed down, you know, that culture of overindulging on beer became, because as well, the alcohol quantity in beer is so much less than spirits. Well, you need to drink an awful lot more, you know what I mean?
Do those day-long drinking sessions, which obviously...
Absolutely.
Some of the statistics around this really did boggle me, though. This idea where you've got this... I never realised how schizophrenic... I suppose is one way of putting it, that Irish attitudes to alcohol are in this, that it's almost you're either abstaining or at the other end of the spectrum, you're drinking vast, vast quantities of alcohol.
I think you have to look at the role that the church plays with that abstinence as well, because
no, for sure.
I went to school throughout the 1990s, and I still, when I made my confirmation, I had to take a pledge of abstinence, and that was in 2001, 2002. So, without a doubt, the high levels of abstinence, when you consider Ireland as a drinking country, and you quoted the figures there from the 1960s, the Catholic Church had a massive influence on Irish culture and the development of the Republic of Ireland and how it grew. So I think you definitely see these two ends of the extremes, and one end is driven by the church, but the other end is driven by a poor legacy of our societal relation with alcohol, without a doubt.
I think, though, personally, I would say I don't think either are very healthy.
No.
Because it's not actually getting people to understand. The ideal situation is that people would be able to have a drink, and then that's fine. You know, as you see in lots of other countries, the problem is in Ireland is it's almost like, don't drink that. And I think that almost creates this idea. It almost creates this idea of the desired thing that you're not allowed to have.
The forbidden fruit.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think as well, touching on that, in modern Irish society, you know, you've got certain social events like the 12 pubs of Christmas, where people are going and drinking 12 pints in 12 different pubs, versus as well, it seems to me that we've developed a culture where we either overindulge in alcohol or we go out and don't drink.
But just maybe using that to bring the story full circle, if we started in the medieval period, back to the start of the podcast, I've got a couple of statistics here. And again, these really shocked me. So in 1960, alcohol consumption in Ireland was 4.88 litres of pure alcohol. That's just the way it's been measured. Obviously, people aren't drinking pure alcohol. That's in a lot more drink. But they're drinking 4.88 litres of pure alcohol. By 1993, that had increased to 8 litres. And in 2018, it was at 11 litres. So while we could talk back and say there was these problems in the early 20th century, like, the problem today is actually, if anything, as bad and worse. And I think the things that are fueling that are different. I think, I suppose the recession had a big impact, that people couldn't afford to go to pubs. They're drinking from off licences at home. And then that
without
way,
a doubt,
you can drink a lot more. There's lots of things going on. And I think you have to be careful as to what we ascribe to this.
I suppose the point on people drinking at home as well is the pub closes. Your home doesn't.
And so you can end up drinking huge quantities at home.
Exactly. I also think as well, like, you're dead right, Finn, in what you say, that consumption fluctuates with different levels of economic prosperity in a country. But the difference between Ireland today and Ireland in the early 19th century, in the famine era, is the accessibility to people in poverty to alcohol today is huge. There's great accessibility to alcohol, whereas maybe today.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like, you can go into a supermarket and buy vast quantities of alcohol for, you know, relatively small quantities of money. You know, the value of alcohol isn't that great, whereas, you know, in 19th century Ireland, you could probably argue that if you didn't have any means and you were on the poverty line, it would be very difficult to access quantities of alcohol.
There is one interesting thing, and I don't know if this is hope for the future, as we kind of bring the podcast to a conclusion, but young people today, and this is actually probably just bringing in another problem that's way beyond the scope of
us two in a pub
and the scope of a history podcast, but younger people today, there's lots of indications that younger people today are not drinking as much, say, as our generation. I'm 38 and DJ is
30.
But, like, DJ is probably saying he's not of my generation. But certainly people in their early 20s, surveys indicate they're not drinking as much.
Yeah.
Now, why that is happening, people have argued it's not happening because of social media. People are it's not that they're not drinking because they don't want to drink and they see it as being unhealthy, which obviously it is, but that they're afraid that if they do drink, that they'll be videoed by their friends. This will end up on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, whatever, and that it'll go viral and they'll be absolutely humiliated. And I was very surprised when I read that, but that was cited as one reason. I think that's opened up a whole other problem that society faces in terms of like that. That's not healthy either. But I did find it interesting that like it is, I suppose, an older generation that are drinking more now, whereas traditionally you would have always associated the heaviest drinkers in society as people probably being in their 20s who are better able to absorb alcohol or whatever and don't have the commitments.
Yeah. Without a doubt. I think what you're touching on there, Finn, is young people's attitude to alcohol has changed. Now, there's a multitude of factors, without a doubt. The problem here is it's very easy to get into anecdotes when you're talking about consumption. And you'll hear anecdotes about people, about young people who go out and they won't drink, but they'll take recreational drugs, etc.
Yeah.
And what I have to say is we as a nation have been very poor at looking at why people do what they do. So why does our generation drink to excess, and why is the younger generation drinking less? Well, you know, I think we definitely need to have a look at society. And the key with doing with looking at history podcasts, looking at incidents that alcohol has fueled throughout our history, looking at the impact it has had in post-famine Ireland and Ireland in the 1920s, is, you know, you have to learn from your history. And if we were to aspire to what Ireland's relationship with alcohol should be in the 2020s, we should learn what it has been previously. And I think you were talking earlier about what we try and do in Snowcast. Right? Yeah, is promote this whole idea of going for a few pints. Why do people go for a few pints traditionally?
And do you think, just on that, do you think the emergence of craft beer and things like that are positive or negative? Like, just the one thing I would say is craft beers vary massively in alcohol content.
Yeah.
So you can end up drinking something that's maybe 6-7% and not realise it. And do you, I don't know, what do you think? Do you think it's a positive or?
My personal attitude to drinking has changed massively in the last couple of years. I was a big advocate of going out on a Saturday and drinking 10, 12 pints and drinking yourself into a lovely drunken state and going home.
Yeah.
Whereas now I can think of nothing better than going to somewhere that will have a good selection of craft beers that are brewed locally, that are brewed with local produce, and you can actually talk to the barman about them. What are they? What does it taste like? And get a taste of what the beer is and find out what the percentage is and gauge yourself. And then make a calculated decision that, you know what, 2 or 3 pints of this and good conversation engaged with someone will actually benefit me a lot more than drinking 12 pints and feeling terrible tomorrow. And that's the relationship with alcohol I'd love to see Ireland move into, where we can support local breweries and support our local pub, go and have 2 or 3 pints of the locally brewed stuff and have a good, decent conversation. Sit down around the table like we are now,
having
a couple of pints of a beer that's brewed in Kilkenny.
But yeah, just on that, I guess I'd have a slightly different perspective on this.
Yeah.
And like maybe we'll wrap up soon enough, but I'm just not sure whether like, does it matter if a brewery is local? Like that's just my, like I think it's kind of coming back to this thing.
Yeah.
It's, okay, is alcohol the problem and our relationship to it? And does it really matter then if it's brewed in, like you can make all sorts of economic arguments about everything I'm buying locally on that level, whatever, you can have that argument. But just in terms of alcohol,
socially, I don't know, does it matter that much?
I
don't think you're wrong. I don't think socially it matters that much. And I think no matter what's in the glass, the question to ask yourself is, why am I sitting with the glass?
Well, on that, I'm going to bring this episode to a close. That's the most contemporary, I think, the show has ever gone. And as I said, Partisans is coming back. That won't be till February because next Wednesday, in a couple of days' time, I'm off to an archive and hopefully I might have great content for you that's never been seen before that will come out of that and will form some of the episodes of Partisans going forward. Thanks a million to DJ for coming up. Really appreciate all your insights there, DJ. They were brilliant. If you want to check out DJ's podcast, it's Snugcast. Unfortunately, Owen, the co-host, couldn't make it today, but it's well worth tuning into Snugcast. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks a million, DJ.
Thanks a million to everyone for listening, and keep up the good work, Finn. Loving
it. Thanks. I'll be back next week with something else before Partisans comes back in February. Until then, so on.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.